about to hear a program from the Aloud Archives in tribute to one of America's most distinguished journalists, David Halberstam, who was killed in a car crash in the San Francisco Bay Area in April of 2007. Mr. Halberstam won a Pulitzer Prize at age 30 for his prophetic reporting in the early days of the Vietnam War. He visited the Aloud series on October 7, 2002, to talk with historian Stephen J. Ross about his work in journalism and specifically the impact of Vietnam on post-Cold War U.S. foreign policy, the subject of his book, War in a Time of Peace, Bush, Clinton, and the Generals.
It's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's special guest, David Halberstam, a distinguished historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author of 18 books, 10 of which have been national bestsellers. Harper's Magazine has called him a legend in American journalism. Newsday has praised him simply as one of our great reporters. Bob Woodward of Watergate fame declared him the journalistic father to a generation of us who went into the profession because of what he did in Vietnam. Why did you become a journalist, and what led you to choose these themes to write about?
I went to Harvard in the early 50s. As I said, came from a public high school. I think probably I was ADD. We didn't know about that then. We didn't have it in the vocabulary. But there was a sort of limited attention span, and I know more about it now. My wife's always been convinced I had it. But the one thing I was good at was the Harvard Crimson, a quality college daily, six times a week, and it was natural for me, learning in an auditory way, writing quickly. I mean, it was easy for me, and I liked it and did it, and I couldn't see any other outlet. I mean, I wasn't going to be a classic historian. I didn't do well. I wasn't able to write a thesis as an undergraduate. And so journalism having come naturally, I decided to try it. It was when I graduated, it was a year after Brown versus Board of Education, 1955. I thought that I needed a year or two of apprenticeship, and if I was going to do that, I it was one thing to be managing under the Crimson, but I had a sense that in journalism, the good jobs were very, very good, but there weren't many of them, and therefore you ought to really prepare yourself unusually well, and I certainly did part of it well, and I had the credentials because of the Crimson. But I needed to know how to talk to people, to learn and to do this in adverse situations. So it was a year after Brown versus Board of Education. The place to learn, obviously, was the South. The most recalcitrant state was Mississippi. I was promised a job by someone I'd met my senior year on a new semi-liberal paper in Jackson. That job, when I got down there, was not forthcoming. My benefactor was not working for the new liberal paper. He was personal assistant to the famously racist editor of the famously racist Jackson Daily News. But they found me a job on the smallest daily in the state. And I went over there, $46 a week, an extra dollar, 45 really, but an extra dollar for me to cover the Kiwanis Club, which I didn't really much enjoy doing. I never felt so alien in my life. But it was a great year in the sense of working in adversarial circumstances among people who were different, learning how to get around, how to deal with a complicated culture, probably the making of me, expanding vision. I did some writing for Liberal Magazine, The Reporter, in those days, and then was lucky enough to go to a very good paper in the early civil rights days in Nashville. Probably, I would think, the best paper in the South in those days. But out of that came an ability, I learned in an auditory way. I got to be very good at interviewing. I mean, the things that had been the weakest part of my game became the strongest part. When I got to Nashville, which was the Tennessean was a very good, aggressive paper, I simply studied everybody on that paper who was a good digging reporter and what made them good, and I would go out every night to dinner with them, and I was just absorbing all that stuff like a sponge. And so when the Times offered me a job after 4 years in Nashville in the much-prized Washington Bureau, I went, it was the day after John Kennedy's election, and I was I went and I was really ready to go. I'd been covering very tough stories in the Crucible, so early civil rights stories, scary stories really, for 4 or 5 years, and I was ready to work, play in the major leagues really. And so when they sent me almost within 6 months, first to the Congo and then to Vietnam, I was a really well-trained reporter who knew what he was about and how to do it and had a complete sense of confidence of my working procedures.
So, what about the themes? There's such an eclectic range of themes, and you know, so many reporters and writers will stick to what they know best, and you've ranged over just such a, you know, panoramic.
Well, I think of it as being paid to learn, and I think that's been the best part of my career. I mean, I think it allows you to grow. I think there's been a fairly systematic growth in me intellectually over the years. I think the books reflect that. And I've gone to what I'm curious about. I mean, certainly the book that defined my career and changed my life was The Best and the Brightest. Up till then, I'd done books that were very derivative of sort of journalism. You sat there, you did your regular journalism, and then you sort of collected the work into a book, and they weren't books of great dimension. They're okay. There's, you know, I mean, they're defensible, but they're not distinguished books. Best and the Brightest was different. That was the first time I went all out for 3 or 4 years and did almost nothing but worked on a book. And it was driven by an anger over Vietnam, a sense that it was a failure, a sense that the people who were the architects of it and had made those miscalculations were not willing to come forward in the public debate and say they had miscalculated. I mean, I've never believed in war crimes very much, but I do believe if there's a crime, it was the crime of silence. That as the debate in this country raged in the late 60s and the early 70s, and they stood on the sidelines. I once had a fascinating argument with the dean of my old college, McGeorge Bundy, when I was doing that book early on. I went in to interview him, and he was still the great McGeorge Bundy. I thought he was by then the head of the Ford Motor Company. And I said, how can you, 1969, how can you be silent? I mean, here's this debate going on and you're silent. And he said, that's very arrogant of you to even comment like that. And he was a master of the put down. And I said, no, it's arrogant of you to be on the sidelines on this one. So it was, I suppose, a tie game argument. That book, I sat and I thought someone ought to do that. I mean, I'd gone to Vietnam for the second tour. I did about 2 years there, and the second tour was in 67, and I was very melancholy about it. There were 500,000 people, Americans there, and I didn't think we were going to win, which meant we were going to lose. I thought it was, in effect, a stalemate, our military superiority versus their political superiority, their capacity to replenish. And everybody there in the American mission was very optimistic. They were talking about the light at the end of the tunnel party and stuff like that. And a couple months later, the Tet Offensive came. And 1968, I covered, that was the tumultuous year. Martin King was killed. Bobby Kennedy was killed. The Democratic Convention was chaotic. And when it was over, I thought, what do I do? And then I thought a book on how and why we went to the war, because it was very clear to me that it was effectively over, which I started in 69. I got a $45,000 advance, which means $41,000 for 4 years. But I thought someone ought to do it. The one person who might have done it better was my colleague Bernard Fall, but he'd been killed a year earlier in Vietnam. So I thought I wasn't a historian, I was thought of myself as a journalist, but I thought if I go out and do 2 interviews a day for 2.5 years and then a year and a half writing, I can do this. I mean, I now, because I knew Vietnam and I could do the history, I thought I could make that jump to being a historian. And I was able to because of that book, and it gave me the confidence and the leverage to go on and do subsequent books. So some of it, to go back to your question, is driven by experience, things that fascinate you and you're pulled towards. Some of the social cultural stuff, the children, is just about having been in the civil rights movement and witnessing America change so dramatically over the 40 or 50 years since my generation graduated from college. I mean, technological revolution, television, all these things that have speeded up the cycle of our lives and made our lifestyle so different from our that of our parents and grandparents. And then the sports books are driven just, you know, they're a great window on America. It's a way to catch your breath after you've done very long, hard books, and they're fun. And I like the people I meet doing them. So it's a sort of a paid vacation, I guess. And it's you know, there's a great moment. One day I was in Cleveland. Summer of 49 had come out, and I did a talk show in midday, and me, the local announcer, and Bob Feller. Bob Feller, for those of you who are Van Meter, Iowa, I do believe, you know, Rapid Robert in the vernacular of the dreadful sports writers of that day, you know, the great pitcher of my childhood. And when the session was over, he turned to me and said, "Would you sign this book for me?" So I guess there's, you know, it's all part of a very rich life. And I think I'm driven by curiosity. What makes these things happen? What happened? And you're always learning.
What'd you find the most challenging book to write?
Oh. The book, The Reckoning, about America and Detroit and Japan. I mean, first off, I'm not a business reporter, so it was like playing, if you're in baseball, 162 games on an away schedule. It was just away from my natural strengths, which are political, social, cultural. I had to have everything explained two or three times. And then Japan is a very hard country in which to work. It's not the language, it's culturally. The Japanese are taught to keep things in, not to express themselves, not to give opinions. So that was hard. And then Detroit is not an easy place. It was just a very hard book where I, to get the kind of authority that you need to do it, just took a long time. It was an alien book, and when it was done, I was very proud of it, and I was sort of relieved that I wouldn't have to do it again.
Well, to leap ahead to your current work now, and one that I know you'll be signing outside, and if those of you have gotten hardback copies, the difference between the hardback and the paper is not just the cover, but there is an epilogue here that is a post-September 11th epilogue. Do you see War in a Time of Peace as a bookend or a sequel to The Best and Brightest?
Yes, it did. I mean, I went away from that vineyard. Best and the Brightest started in 1969 and came out in 72. When it came out, I had a lot of offers for a lot of money to do, in effect, son of Best and Brightest, i.e. Nixon, Kissinger, whatever they were doing at the time. And I deliberately did not want to walk in the same vineyard. I think I'm at my best when I am learning, when I'm curious. I think that your work is driven by curiosity, by not knowing the answer to things. You know, you're starting out with a question. In The Best and the Brightest, it was the people in the Kennedy administration were allegedly the ablest people of a generation, and yet Vietnam was one of the worst tragedies of the century. Therefore, how could it have happened? Who were they? What? How did and why did they get it wrong? The powers that be, which was on the media, was driven by the question in Watergate in Vietnam, the adversaries were the president, not really the opposition party, but the president and, to no small degree, the media. And therefore, why had that happened, i.e. the growth of television as a monstrous, new, powerful force with a home entertainment system. Book that came out in 79. So in The Reckoning, it was when World War II was over. Japan was in ashes. Now we are talking about embargoes to limit their cars because they're making better cars than we are. How did that happen? It's driven that. So it took a long time to go back to the vineyard of foreign policy connected to domestic policy. I mean, what are the forces domestically that drive the decisions in foreign policy? And I was at a cocktail party when the Bosnian bombing began, and I saw my friend Les Gelb, who is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I said, I wasn't really following as closely as I should have, you know, what's driving this? Is it Madeleine Albright's war, as people say? And he said, actually, the vice president is probably the biggest hawk. And I thought, that's interesting. That could be a good magazine article. So I called my friend who's the editor of Vanity Fair and said, would he do that? Would he be interested? And he said yes, and I started doing it as a magazine piece, and I thought, well, that's a good little essay book, and I got my publisher's permission. And then I went down to Washington for a week. And, you know, you're always listening when you're doing a book. You're not just interviewing, you're listening. I think you're trying to listen at double dimension, not just to what they're saying, but what it means. And somewhere in my papers now, I have a long handwritten note that facts that I sent from the Jefferson Hotel in Washington to my lawyer agent, and sort of talking about expanding it to a full book. And I have said that when I did the book, I didn't go looking for the ghosts of Vietnam. They came and found me. But what I found very early on was that two institutions in this country that I think are vital to a healthy society were disproportionately damaged by the Vietnam War. I mean, this is more than 25 years since the last troops have left there. And most of the rest of us have gone on to our lives. But the Democratic Party, which has been out of power for 20 of 24 years, is damaged, and people like Clinton. Clinton had a constant problem in his presidency because he had not gone, a problem that would not affect the Republicans, in a comparable absence of service. And the United States Army, we'd sent a very good army there, but because it was a bad war, it had picked up any number of viruses. And in fact, if you ask Colin Powell what he's proudest of, it's not being Secretary of State or Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, it's being one of the people who helped cleanse the United States Army. So you had these two institutions that had really been jarred badly by this experience. And when Colin Luther Powell met William Jefferson Clinton, they were in the same room. And that greatly affected our decision-making on Bosnia and on the Balkans and on other foreign policy issues. So I found myself drawn back to the intersection of domestic politics and foreign policy. And it was really the bookend. It was the book. I hadn't intended it to be that way, to be that when I started, but I found my way to that as I pursued it.
Now, the book is, to my mind, a book about personalities, politics, and the policies that collectively shape our national security policy. And it's also a book or a story of heroes and less than heroes, of those who rise to the occasion with a clear head and vision for the future, and those who are either concerned with protecting their turf or stuck in their past. And it seemed to me there were sort of two bookend heroes. On the political front, we have Anthony Lake, who is the head of the National Security Council, and Richard Holbrooke, who is the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs. And then on the military end, you've got Colonel John Ward, who designed the air campaign for Desert Storm, but at the cost of earning the wrath of his superiors, and General Wesley Clark, a former Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas, who commands the air war against Serbia in 1999, and then found himself forced to retire by envious Pentagon leaders. What made them heroic in your mind?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I think some of the people you mentioned don't think that they're heroic and are quite angry about the portrayal in the book. By the way, the person I would add as a person of uncommon ability would be General John Shalikashvili, who I think is one of the most underrated and one of the most valuable public officials of the last 20 or 30 years. Extraordinary, thoughtful, decent, surprisingly eloquent. I mean, a very, very good citizen and a man. He never entered the larger public imagination, particularly after someone as dramatic a figure as Colin Powell preceded him, but he was an uncommon man and a man who's really admirable. Well, Tony Lake, I think, hates the book and does not think it's a very, I think, generous portrayal of it. Dick Holbrooke, who's probably comes out better in the book when he first got it, and God, I've known Dick since 1962 in Vietnam, and Dick didn't couldn't deal with my portrait of him, and I didn't hear from him, and I didn't hear from him. Finally, our mutual friend Les Gelb called him up and said, "Dick, you stop whining. You like the book. You like the book." And at which point he called him and said the book was fine. I think he was resentful of my quoting someone that Holbrook was the kind of person, it was said, who could go in a revolving door behind you and come out ahead of you. So, I mean, but he's enormously talented. It's a great intelligence. So going through all four of them, Tony Lake, I think, was a guy somewhat damaged by the Vietnam years, very idealistic. I mean, really what he wanted to do was be a Foreign Service officer in Africa and do humanitarian things. Got pulled into the early days of the Clinton administration with a president whom he was not on a wavelength with, whose attention he could not get, and who was utterly preoccupied by domestic issues and the economy. So Tony's time in grade in Washington was not comfortable as the NSC guy, and he was not a very happy camper, and it did not work out very well with Clinton. And as you may recall, when he was finally nominated, when they wanted to move him out of the NSC job to the CIA job, there was such resentment that finally the CIA appointment was dropped. Dick Holbrook is interesting. He's so smart, and he has a brilliant sense of the interaction, better than almost anybody I've ever met, the interaction of American domestic politics and foreign policy. If he had chosen journalism in mid-career, he would have been a columnist at the level of Walter Lippmann, because he is so smart and he can see around the corners. It's a truly uncommon intelligence. And in that period, he had a sense that the Balkans were going to be a determining issue, and that the Clinton administration, if it did not pull this off in some way, if it allowed the genocide and the hemorrhaging to continue, it would mark fatally the Clinton administration. And so he was able, with willpower and intellect and hubris, to drive that administration towards a settlement in the Balkans, and finally the Kosovo bombing. John Warden, whom you mentioned, is just a kind of wunderkind of the Air Force, who annoyed all the Air Force traditionalists who had all their own concepts of how to use air power based upon air power in the past. What John Warden did, I stumbled on this. I didn't know any of this. I had to find this out. A brilliant idea how to take our new high technology skills, which are just amazing. I mean, the ability to put laser bombs into the world to hit with this uncommon accuracy the targets that we want and not hit the targets that we don't want. And let me give you an example of that. While we did hit a mislabeled building in Belgrade once in that bombing, when the bombing stopped and the war was over, that city was filled with journalists. And had we done other things that were of the nature of an atrocity, there would have been a lot of writing about it. There was not. I mean, the absence of the dog barking is very important. John Warden came up with the theory of how to numb a modern state by taking out, with your high technology, its nervous system, its communication system. In effect, how to do this while minimizing casualties to the other nation and to your own people. And he really gave the blueprint for the high technology war in the Gulf. Now, that's not always going to be applicable in events of the way we use power, but it's no doubt that he was way ahead of his colleagues at the Air Force. Wes Clark doesn't like the book either. Wes thinks I didn't catch his warmer side. Wes is really smart. I mean, and he's smart in a kind of laser beam way. I mean, he's from Arkansas. He went to West Point. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's always been first in his class. And he doesn't know how to play with the other boys. You know, in the Army, it's okay to be smart, but it's not okay necessarily to show how smart you are. I mean, it's okay. It's better to be smart but not show all of it, to be a guy who can get along with other people. Wes likes to have, he's the kid in class in the eighth grade who always had his hand up first. And that is anti-cultural in the United States Army. So there was a feeling, and he had been brought around as a younger officer. He was, I think, a bit of a protege of Shally Kashvili. And I think that Shally brought him towards and moved him, as did the civilians he worked with, towards some degree of ending the Serbian atrocities and putting a damper on Milosevic. As they did that, when he was the head of forces in NATO, that put him, given the tensions that I've already talked about between the civilians and the military, some of that post-Vietnam, some of it particularly aimed at Clinton, a sense of wariness on the part of senior military, and a particular wariness of getting involved in something in the Balkans that might be a replica of Vietnam. It put him in conflict with most senior people in the military. And there were warnings about, watch out, don't get too close to the people on the other side of the river, that being the White House or the State Department, depending on being on the other side of the Potomac. So that when he pulled off this rather stunningly effective use of American power and UN power in Kosovo, he found himself out of a job and fired within a couple of weeks. So those are the four people that you have named, plus Shally Kashvili, who is really, I think, an uncommon man in the best sense of being a soldier and a citizen and someone who knows more than most people think he knows and came here. I mean, it's really quite an amazing thing about America if you think of Brzezinski, Kissinger, born in Firth, Germany, Madeleine Albright, I believe, born in Prague, Shalik, Colin Powell, born of Jamaican immigrant parents, and John Shally Kashvili, born of parents from the Soviet Georgia in Warsaw. I mean, and all these men and women rising to these highest levels, and there's no other country in the world where that would happen.
Let me ask you one more question, yeah, and then we'll throw it out to the audience. If President George W. Bush were to read your book after a strenuous golf game, and he's going home, and it's the evening, and he starts reading it, what lessons would you like him to take away from it?
Well, I'd like him to read both books, because I think you can't read this book without reading the preceding book. And in that preceding book, which I think is really about more about who we are, there is a quote that George Ball, who was the leading dove, put down in one of his dove papers. George had been a young attorney in France during the French Indochina War, so he had a profound sense of the limits of Western power on the Indochina peninsula. And he headed one of his dove papers with a quote from Emerson, from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it went, it's just jumps in my mind whenever I think of where we are today. Events are in the saddle and ride mankind. And what that means is you come to these decisions and you think you control events. You think you control the game, but you don't. You make a play, you put in play other things, other people make a play. You don't really control the play very often the way you think you do. In Vietnam, as I sort of pointed out earlier, we had absolute military superiority. There was not a set-piece battle, given the extraordinary quality of our technology and our armaments, that we were not going to win. If there was a battle like the Iedrang, and I commend everyone here to read my colleague and friend Hal Moore, General Hal Moore's book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, which is about the first main force battle in Vietnam in the Iedrang Valley. It's the best book on combat that I've in Vietnam I've ever read. If there was a main force, if there was a battle like that, and we killed 1,100 NVA or VC and lost only 100 Americans, that Westie thought that was a victory. But they had absolute political superiority, which meant they could be out recruiting or sending more men down the funnel from Hanoi the next day. So that we were in a stalemate war. And it's, you're talking about situations where the military part may end up being smaller, and your use, your application of military force may be less effective because, for a variety of ethnic, cultural, and economic reasons, the political forces, historic reasons, the political forces aligned against you are so powerful that you cannot really penetrate them, that they work against your military force. And I think that that is one of the lessons of the best and the brightest. I want to thank you very much for the support of the library. We need a library, so we really need people like you. Thank you very much for what you've done.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.